draw that carbon down to the bottom of the sea? Or what is where an awful lot of money is going today in engineered removals, direct air capture? This is an artist's impression. Imagine vast arrays of kind of air conditioning units which suck carbon dioxide directly out of the atmosphere. That gas is compressed and then pumped deep underground, probably into, not exclusively, but probably into depleted oil and gas fields where it will stay forever.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We return to UK Professor James Dyke, laying out the harsh truth of warming beyond the safe zone, where we are, and what it means. This lecture was recorded at the University of Exeter on December 10th, 2025, and is rebroadcast with permission.
This is a bit of a snark. Better late than never. It's been relatively late that the climate science community, the earth science community, the people who are involved in thinking about carbon budgets, have made it really quite unambiguously clear that a lot of the approaches, or maybe assumptions around overshoot, are not very credible, right? There is overconfidence in our ability to be able to remove large amounts of carbon dioxide. Sustainability are needed, because if you undergo large-scale afforestation, probably as part of BECCS, bioenergy carbon capture and storage, you could threaten water security, food security, you could displace people from the land, you could decimate biodiversity. There could be a whole bunch of bad things that could result from that attempted climate solution. There is over-reliance on land for carbon dioxide removal. When you add up all the land, just simply in terms of land surface, there just doesn't seem to be enough to be able to take out what could be heroic amounts of carbon dioxide. And this means there is essentially a carbon dioxide removal gap. And I would say to this, just very briefly, what do you think policymakers would do if you provided them with an option to not undergo rapid mitigation, but propose future technological solutions that will recover us back into a safe climate? This should surprise nobody. And it is quite interesting how it has been relatively late that the academic community has, through important work, been making clear that some of the promises of overshoot may not be delivered. There's other ways to think about this conceptually. I always like the work of David Ho. He's a US geoscientist who imagines carbon dioxide removal as a sort of time machine, right? So if you think about cumulative emissions determine total amount of warming, and those emissions have built up over time, well, carbon dioxide removal is trying to go back in time to unwind some of those emissions. And the point that David makes through this analogy is that our ability to go back in time is currently extraordinarily feeble. Looking at engineered emissions, if you take a year's worth of greenhouse carbon dioxide emissions, which is the best part of 40 billion tons a year, over that entire year, we're maybe able to wind the clock back maybe a few minutes or something, right? It just doesn't have any meaningful impact. The other analogy that I would suggest we think about this is in terms of parachutes. This idea that a parachute is a safety device, it can save your life, or in this case, it's safely arresting some kind of payload down to Earth. But parachutes can only work at certain speeds. If you try and put something that is far too heavy on that parachute, it accelerates the parachute, and the parachute has become impaired, damaged, it will rip, and then it's about as much use as a chocolate fire guard, right? So these technologies have a purpose, they have a potential role, but it has to be in the context of decarbonisation. So the way that David describes it, yes, we could deploy CDR, but CDR is only really going to make sense once we've done the bulk of our decarbonisation. Supposing that it can somehow offset 40 billion tonnes a year is just dangerously uninformed. So that's the climate system. In some respects, that's the good news, because the bad news is that the Earth system is responding to human impacts, not just in terms of it's getting warmer, heat waves are increasing, but there is perhaps evidence that elements of the Earth system is losing resilience, is becoming less able to deal with anthropogenic forcing. So what this video shows is a visualization of carbon dioxide emissions. So CO2 is a well-mixed gas. Doesn't really matter where you emit it, but you can see these points here. These are individual power stations, right? And it's well mixed. So it doesn't matter if it happens in Baltimore or Birmingham or Bangalore, that carbon dioxide would eventually migrate its way throughout the entire planet. But this is what I'm particularly interested in. This pulsing, this is showing the day-night cycle, and it's the drawing down of carbon dioxide during the day and then respiring carbon dioxide out through the significant areas of terrestrial vegetation, for example, the Asian and the sub-Saharan African rainforests. It's this cycling of carbon through days, through months, through years, and over long time scales, which has been importantly buffering up our emissions of greenhouse gases. So you probably already know about half of all the carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere each year, about 40 billion tons, half of it ends up in the sea or on land. So about a quarter in the land and a quarter in the sea. If those natural carbon sinks start to fail, if they start to slow down the amount of carbon dioxide they remove from the atmosphere, or in some place even begin to put carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere through outgassing, we go for a situation where it becomes a sink to a source, then the challenge we've got when it comes to carbon dioxide removal becomes much, much more serious. So I'm thinking about now the planetary perspective. So one of the things we were very mindful of when we met in June was the planetary boundaries concept, because our lead author for this paper was Johan Rockström, and Johan has pioneered the application and development of the planetary boundaries framework. Here it is in 2009, and it imagined you've got these various dimensions of the Earth system. You've got climate change, yes, biosphere integrity, land system change, freshwater use, biogeochemical flows, ocean acidification, atmospheric aerosol loading, stratospheric ozone depletion, and novel entities. And human impacts are radiating out, such if we're in the circle, we're in this kind of safe zone. And as you're going further from this kind of circle, we're entering the increasing zone of uncertainty and then into the danger zone. And back in 2009, the big ones were biosphere integrity, just a simple result of land use change, ecosystem destruction, biodiversity loss. Whatever the rate of biodiversity loss or species loss was before humans, it's probably much, much higher now, maybe thousands, maybe tens of thousands higher. They're tens of thousands times higher than the background extinction rate. Climate change was, of course, a concern, but then also biogeochemical flows, the sheer amount of nitrogen and phosphorus fertilizer that we put on the ground on farmlands, which is having a devastating impact on aquatic ecosystems. Well, as the years have gone by, the number of boundaries that have been assessed to have crossed have increased. So we are today in 25. We determined that there are about 9 boundaries been assessed, and 7 of those are crossed. Biosphere integrity is being broken up into terms of functional biodiversity, of genetic, which is kind of simple and a measure of the total numbers of species. Novel entities is of serious risk because of the increasing number of industrial processes, the new species of chemicals that we're producing that we have really no idea about. Things like PFAS or plastics, microplastics has been really capturing people's attention. And climate change in terms of CO2 concentrations and radiative forces. So we're going backwards, right? Or forwards in the wrong direction. So this is what we wanted to talk about. And the way that we considered we're going to visualize that is this. And this is a complicated picture. And I don't have much time, but I will do my best. We've got this kind of idea of a planetary boundary safe and just space. We were kind of still well within it in 1997, the Kyoto Protocol, and we could have turned back then, right? There were some bold promises made by the international community about stopping the dangerous interference. There was a whole series of missed opportunities, and then something of maybe of a reset in 2015. We could have turned round, but we didn't. We have what we call this missed decade of climate action. So here we are now in 2025, where we need to undertake a rapid, radical pivot in order to meet our sustainable development goals, many of which are stalling or even going in reverse. So that's not good. But turn this thing around such that we recover back into a safe space, which is going to have to be net negative somehow by the end of the century. If we don't do that, if we continue exceeding these planetary boundaries, then we get to this point of a critical juncture. with this idea of a planetary threshold tipping points. I'll talk about those briefly in a moment. And then when we were developing this figure, I said, no, look, it's not a discrete threshold, right? It's going to be increasing kind of a graduated range of risk. So don't make this a solid line. So the designer came back, okay, I'll make little dots in it. Okay, fine. But it's the idea that there is this kind of this notion of a critical juncture, which I tried to capture with the notion of derailment risk that I'll talk about later, where if we can't turn things around, it becomes increasingly likely that we just end up making things even worse. So up here, we've got social unrest, failure to meet SDGs, generally very bad, not just Earth system, not just bad climate outcomes, but bad social outcomes, because we would have failed to both arrest warming, arrest the exceedance of other planetary boundaries, and also fail to meet our sustainable development goals. What this is, in some respect, is kind of an overshoot. And an overshoot, you should be expecting a correction. So none of this is new. The first world conference on the, not just the climate, but the Earth system, the human environment, was back in 1972. 1972 was also the date of publication of the famous, infamous book, Limits to Growth, of which popularized this notion that we could exceed boundaries, we could exceed limits, and if you do that, then you're going to undertake a correction, and that correction could be interpreted as some kind of extremely bad outcome for society, maybe some kind of collapse. So us saying somehow we've exceeded this notion of a safe space, we've exceeded boundaries, therefore there might be some kind of extremely unpleasant consequence in the pipeline, is nothing new in some respects. So enter Overshoot Plus. So we've had net zero, we've had overshoot, and now we're entering the region of Overshoot Plus, I would argue, because if you are paying attention, you can see this narrative is now increasing. So Overshoot Plus has us think that temperature exceeds this threshold, whether it's 1.5 or 2, or maybe within a planetary threshold, with the deployment of CDR, carbon dioxide removal, will be dragging temperatures down. But in the meantime, we have geoengineering, which is going to shave off maximum temperatures. So this is some work that I've been progressing with Mandy Bissett. And the starting point was a recent paper by Hyslop that referred back to some older work. So I did not know back that John Shepherd came up with this, co-authored the napkin, what's called the napkin diagram, because apparently they scrawled on the back of a napkin. And what it shows is how increases in temperature could be, in some respects, managed or regulated through a portfolio of approaches, right? So here we are now, and here we are 200 years into the future. So one thing I want to point out right away is that Overshoot Plus is making the assumption that we are going to be doing things not just for years or decades, but centuries. So this is a multi-generational project we've set ourselves. Here we've got business as usual. Well, we don't want that because we're going to have temperatures sometime around the end of this century, which is kind of 5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial periods, and that's catastrophic. So what we'll do is we'll take mitigation, which is this curve. But mitigation is assumed to only be able to reduce warming by so much. So you add in CDR, this curve, well, that's going to apply a reducing factor, right? But it's SRM, solar radiation management, which you need because you can scale that pretty quickly such that we can limit warming to 2 degrees Celsius. And then with adaptation, we can even take it down even further so that the consequence of the amount of warming is not so that it produces a level of impacts or suffering that are considered to be unacceptable, right? Mitigate, CDR, SRM, that's the approach. And how are we going to do that? Well, most of the action at the moment is in solar radiation management. There is some cloud thinning as well, but the main attempt is to reduce the amount of energy that's received on the surface of the Earth from the sun, right? And how are we going to do that? Well, we could increase surface albedo, the brightness, so marine cloud brightening, make very highly reflective bubbles and clouds. Most of the interest seems to be much higher up in the atmosphere towards the higher portions of the troposphere, stratospheric aerosol injection. If you inject sulfurous compounds into the high portions of the atmosphere, it mimics the actions of a large volcanic eruption. There have been eruptions, most noticeably Pinatubo in the early 90s, that had a global cooling effect for a few years of maybe up to half a degree Celsius. If we replicate that by flying millions of sorties of wide-bodied aircraft that have been converted into tankers and then spray these sulfurous compounds, then we could have an immediate cooling effect. It won't do anything in terms of carbon dioxide concentrations, won't do anything in terms of ocean acidification, but it would buy us vital time in order for us to be able to recover back into safety. That's the plan. And I think this is the plan you're going to hear an awful lot more about as temperatures and impacts increase. But here's the thing about overshoot. In much of the overshoot discourse, it's assumed to be a temporary and a recoverable from. But there's nothing about the definition of the term. Overshoot just means to go past an intended stopping or turning point inadvertently. We've overshot something. And overshooting is, in some contexts, extremely serious. Overshooting a runway excursion, produces significant damage. We would be talking about millions of dollars to fix that airframe, not to mention what other kind of insurance costs you're going to get. The airframe could be entirely lost because of the overshoot, and there could also be associated loss of life. So this is the recent 29th of December, 24. Feels more recent than that. A flight from Bangkok that was landing in South Korea undertook an overshoot, and there is a video that shows the crash. So depending on how you feel about such things, I mean, just don't look at the video. You can't see anyone, but it's obviously a plane crashing. I want to show the plane crashing because it is important to see the conditions of the actual incident, right? The thing to bear in mind here is that the landing gear is not down, the flaps are not set, the aircraft is clearly not configured to land, and it's sliding along the entire length of the runway, but it's what happens there. So the story appears to be that the aircraft was coming into land and there was a bird strike. It flew through a flock of migrating ducks. It took out one of the engines. It possibly took out both of the engines. So the pilots attempted to make an immediate landing, and some reason, somehow, the landing gear was not deployed. So they didn't have wheels and brakes to slow down, but also the flaps were not deployed, and flaps are surfaces at the trailing edge of the wings that seriously or significantly slow down the stall speed of the aircraft to allow it to take off with less runway in order for it to land with less runway. But the reason that was a catastrophe, so there were 181 people on that aircraft and two people survived. The two people that survived were two crew members strapped in right at the rear of the aircraft. And as the tail section separated from the rest of the airframe, they were actually relatively unharmed, but everybody else died because it impacted that large structure. And this is the tragic irony about this incident. And this is why I think it's got important lessons to tell us around managing risks with regards to overshoot. Because what is this thing? Well, this thing is a part of the ILS system, the instrument landing system. It's also got a light array on it. But these systems are designed in order to allow planes to land safely, right? So if it's low visibility, in fact, even if there's zero visibility, this system allows planes to land in situations or circumstances where they would not be allowed to land or be able to land in the absence of it. But of course, by situating it there and putting it in this very large concrete structure, they made a situation which was serious, but potentially survivable, into one that was catastrophic. And of course, a lot of the discussion and the air crash investigation is going to focus on a whole bunch of reasons. One of them, what on earth was this structure doing there? A structure that was meant to be increasing safety actually produced a catastrophic outcome. So we often think about risk in terms of like the Swiss cheese model, right? So if you imagine that you've got slices of Swiss cheese and there's holes in it and you kind of randomly throw them together, it's very unlikely you're going to get a pathway through all those different slices, right? But there are some configurations where there will just be a hole. So in the context of that air disaster, you had the aircraft flew through a flock of birds. You had one of the engines was probably destroyed. Potentially, the pilot also then shut down the other engine by mistake. There was a failure to deploy the landing gear. There was a failure to deploy the flaps. And all of those things could have been survivable, but it's that last slice, that last element, a long-term planning decision by the airport to situate a concrete bunker at the end of a runway, which made a runway overshoot into a mass fatality. So what's that got to do with climate change? It comes back to this notion of what climate change is and what we're meant to be doing. We go back to 1992, the formation of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. What is the point of this organization? To combat the dangerous interference in the climate system. What has this become? To combat the dangerous unintentional interference in the climate system. We didn't mean to put all these greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. With the deliberate or intentional interference. So earlier this year, I contributed to some work. Again, Mandy Bissett was involved, but this was led by Olivia Lazard, and I've done a number of projects with her. When we tried to think about geoengineering risk or the deliberate interference in the Earth system with regards to trying to limit overshoot risks, and there's a number of things that I think are important with some of this work. There are risks involved when we undertake this kind of solar radiation management or any kind of geoengineering risk. The first is that, well, it just doesn't work, right? Or it might even have a counterproductive effect. The second one is that it may cause harm, and certainly some geoengineering will, in terms of air pollution, let's say. Or it could exacerbate international tensions. And I know some of the people most concerned around solar radiation management are most concerned about it because of the geopolitical implications. How are we going to manage the deployment of solar radiation management? What happens when country A deploys a sulfur injection and then country B experiences some kind of extreme weather event? How does that complicate the already very fraught situation of climate change policy negotiations? And the thing with SRM, we always know that there's this thing of termination shock. If you stop it relatively quickly, then its effect fades. And if you haven't reduced emissions in that time, well, then we know that global average temperatures could increase very quickly. I think more importantly, we've got systemic destabilization potentials. And then you've got this notion of overshoot risk. So the new series of risks that are going to be generated because we are now in a period of overshoot. And geoengineering is just one of them, right? Now, some people will argue that you can actually manage these kind of overshoot risks by deploying geoengineering, or there's a compelling reason to do so. So, for example, AMOC shutdown. I just find it astonishing that some of the science is concluding that the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation, even on a low emissions trajectory, has got basically a 1 in 5 chance of shutdown.
Right.
Because the consequences of AMOC shutdown is described as a tipping point we must not cross. Right. So basically, we need geoengineering to scale up in order to be able to somehow offset these kind of risks. Well, Mandy and I have had some thoughts about that. There might be some compelling reasons to deploy geoengineering, but we need to be more nuanced. I'm not saying we shouldn't under any circumstances, but at the moment, certainly the kind of discourse and analysis that I see is incredibly crude, if not simple-minded. The risk-risk calculus, and that you've got risks of climate change or risks of geoengineering. And basically, if you just kind of wait long enough, the risks of not doing geoengineering would outweigh the risks of unabated climate change, because climate change risks are potentially almost infinite in economic terms, right? We could lose everything if we go beyond 3, 4, or 5 degrees Celsius. So even though there are risks in geoengineering, we will be forced to deploy it. I think that's problematic for a number of reasons. I've been doing some work thinking about, well, what's geoengineering doing? Well, it's getting us to focus on things like constants, stocks and flows, buffers, relatively superficial. I mean, sounds kind of crazy to call it relatively superficial things to address the climate challenge, when really what we could be doing is deeper engagement using kind of Mellow's typology of deeper interactions, because there are systemic problems that we might need to address. But geoengineering, carbon dioxide removal, what's deemed to be policy relevant, is keeping us in this area. I want to briefly show this figure because this shows who's funding geoengineering in the context of carbon dioxide removal. So this is work that's been led by Mandy Bissett. And when I started working with Mandy, I assumed it's oil and gas that, of course, is all over CDR. And it's not. It's big tech. It's the big tech companies. It's in some places the AI boom, which is driving a significant movement of money into what is in many instances a startup about carbon dioxide removal. Which leads me finally onto this idea of derailment risk. because with increasing overshoot, we're seeing situations where worsening climate consequences has the potential to destabilize societies, which distracts them from decarbonisation, which is ultimately the thing that we must do to stay safe, which will then worsen climate consequences, destabilise societies, and on and on. It doesn't have to be like that. You could imagine that as climate action increases, it reduces climate impacts. But if climate impacts were to increase, it increases climate action, which is a kind of virtuous circle that we want. But the thing I'm particularly concerned around with overshoot is that climate impacts are going to be degrading our abilities to progress decarbonisation. With increasing impacts, destabilisation, political destabilisation and international conflict, and I think we can already see some of the elements of these emerging. You look at the Valencia floods, the destabilisation, the political destabilisation in Valencia after these devastating floods, which benefited climate-denying right-wing political parties. I do just want to point out, what's another way that we can see these kind of derailment risks? Here is the EPA website, the Environmental Protection Agency, about climate change in October 8th, 2025. Causes of climate change, since the Industrial Revolution, human activities have removed large amounts of carbon dioxide, blah, blah, blah. What does it say now? What are the causes? Natural processes are always influencing the Earth's climate, and it can explain climate change prior. However, recent change cannot be explained by natural causes alone. What does it talk about? Change of the Earth's orbit, variation in solar activity, volcanism, and right at the end, it talks about carbon dioxide concentration. It doesn't even mention emissions or human emissions, right? This is the level of denial that a political system is now undergoing in order to try to resist the unavoidable consequences of overshoot. So, ways forward. If you don't do this, then I can't really see much point in doing anything else. We've been saying this for 30 years, so obviously that's not sufficient. We also need to transform food systems into carbon sinks. A current driver of climate change is our food systems, and somehow they need to be transformed, maybe through regenerative processes, probably a significant reduction of animal farming and husbandry and agriculture. We need planetary restoration, not just plant a bunch of trees. Natural ecosystems have been regulating carbon for billions of years, and we need to restore the ones that we destroyed. At the same time, we need to accelerate climate change adaptation because the consequences have already arrived and we can have a massive difference on people's outcome and quality of life through increasing adaptation. And we also need to increase the societal resilience. The energy transition, the sustainability transitions themselves need to be resilient to societal disruption, to the consequence of climate change. And also, I would argue that we need to develop new ways to make polluters pay. Rich industrialized nations are responsible for the climate crisis. They're the ones that should be paying for the loss and damages and the accelerated mitigation that the situation demands. Thank you very much.
From the University of Exeter Global Systems Institute, that was Professor James Dyke. Find links to the video and supporting materials in my weekly show blog, Wednesdays, at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Next week, we go into the evil twin of global warming. Humans are making the ocean more acidic, and that changes everything. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Go no further, no further to go. Speed and space, time and place. Got the limit. Birds and bugs, all that swim, tops of trees, state you're in. All you make, all you take, got a limit. Brother, got a limit. Sister, got a limit. Here we are, trying and crying, love while we can. Downtown, down, downtown, everywhere, every line, at the limit. No further, universe rules, nobody go past it, it's the limit, living at the limit, if you call it that, no matter what you say, here today, at the limit, living large, getting small, limits to it all. Living and trying, caring and crying, out in space.
Broadcasting on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.